Hi, this is Sarah Morgan, one of the voices you've heard on Still. We hope this story moves you, but more than anything, we pray someone will come forward to help solve these tragic cases. Spread the word by posting about Patricia Otto and the Findlay Creek Jane Doe on social media. You can find links to their advocacy pages in our show notes. It's not too late to help these women. The truth is out there. And please take a moment to rate and review us on your favorite podcast app, which helps more people learn about these cases. If you'd like to leave us direct feedback, contact us on Twitter, find us on Facebook, or send an email to info@thereportersnotebook.com. And please, if you know something, come forward. Now, get ready for the next episode of Still.
This podcast contains intense subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
My dad, while he was in prison, tried to keep really busy. So he used his hands to make things. He made a grandfather clock and he made these very impressive dollhouses. So he originally sent the first dollhouse and we were so impressed with this house. It's huge. It's this tall and this wide and I can stand on it right now. Wow. It's so strong. It's heavy. It's amazing. And all these little people, a whole little family. And we thought this was the coolest house ever. And then he told us, I'm building an even better house than this house. You girls are going to be so amazed. In between then, made me a leather vest with my name Dallas on it. A purse with my name Dallas, leather purse. All these little nice things. And then the dollhouse came. And this massive dollhouse has electricity in it. The lights light up. It's everything's handmade. All these wooden pieces of, it's impressive.
And you still have it?
Of course I have it.
Where is it?
It's in the garage.
Suzanne Timms, who of course used to be Dallas Otto, took us to the garage to see the dollhouse. The massive structure would dwarf any of Barbie and Ken's mansions. It has two full stories with dormers on the wood shingled roof, and an attic that opens up to reveal more rooms on the third level. A bay window and covered porch welcome tiny visitors, and the windows are adorned with shutters and curtains.
Like all of this stuff, he made it all by hand. Every piece of furniture is tacked and made. Wood furniture by hand.
Wow.
All the little
drawers.
In prison.
In prison.
All the little drawers open.
Oh my goodness.
There it is right there.
That's the piano. So it's three full stories.
This is a player piano.
Wow. It is.
Let's see this.
Oh, one.
Oh, it winds.
It's craziness.
It's playing that same song. This one's different.
The tiny player piano was a perfect replica of the one Suzanne remembers near the front door of the house on 29th Street.
I've heard songs that have played off that piano before where you're like, I'm right back in the house. So I try to analyze everything, but we loved our dollhouses and we spent so many hours playing perfect family in the dollhouse. And at no point did anybody die in my dollhouse.
From the pages of the Reporter's Notebook. This is Still, Season 2. I'm your host, Gary Anderson. Thank you. At the end of the last episode, retired Union County, Oregon, District Attorney Dale Mammon asked us what happened to Patty Otto's husband, Ralph. This is as good a time as any to fill you in on that. In our minds, it helps explain why the Lewiston Police Department is hesitant to talk with us on the record. In 1981, Ralph's attorney successfully petitioned the Idaho Supreme Court to review his murder-for-hire conviction. His lawyer had been arguing that Ralph's dependence on alcohol made him incapable of fully understanding what he was doing when he paid the undercover cop to kill Lewiston Police Captain Dwayne Ayler. His attorney said it was entrapment for the officer to meet with Ralph to discuss an assassination and then to accept payment for the hit. But as far as the court was concerned, the issue wasn't whether Ralph was culpable for the crime. It was the statute under which he was charged and convicted. The court ended up splitting its decision, voting 3-2, that hiring a hitman did not qualify as attempted murder. Instead, the court wrote in its decision that Ralph was guilty of mere solicitation. He was released from prison 7 years before his sentence would have ended, and he returned to Lewiston, still proclaiming that the cops in his town were crooked and had railroaded him. He started making plans to sue the police. It's probably fair to say that most officers in Lewiston were also still angry with Ralph for trying to have one of their own killed. I imagine that they were particularly resentful that his conviction was overturned. All this was simmering beneath the surface when Lewiston cops came to his door at 9 p.m. September 7, 1983, to arrest Ralph for theft. He had been charged with stealing a chainsaw in nearby Clearwater County, and a judge there issued a bench warrant when he failed to appear in court. Police reports say that Ralph was severely intoxicated when he was picked up, and the arresting officers had to help him walk to the police cruiser. When he was booked into jail in Lewiston at 11:20 p.m., the report indicates Ralph was so intoxicated he was unable to sign the inventory acknowledgement for his belongings. Over the next few hours, various agencies took custody of Ralph. He was first handed over to Nez Perce County Sheriff's deputies, who then passed him on to Clearwater County deputies. The paperwork processing and custody transfers took time, and it was almost 4 a.m. before he made it inside the jail in Orofino. Ralph's family believes that the amount of time it took for him to be booked into the Lewiston jail indicates that police there used the opportunity to try to coerce a confession from him about killing his wife. In the shower room at the Orofino jail, Clearwater County staff saw grotesque injuries on his right ankle and foot. The skin had almost completely separated and was falling off. The jailers called for help, but Ralph lost consciousness before paramedics arrived. He stopped breathing. Officers and paramedics tried to resuscitate him and rushed him to a nearby hospital. Medical personnel at the hospital worked for nearly 2 hours trying to revive him. Ralph was pronounced dead at 7:54 a.m., September 8, 1983.
Yeah, so we were told that he had a heart attack and that he died in the shower. But he's 42. So, like I said, when we got old enough, Natalie wanted to know what happened, so she requested the autopsy, and we got the photos. I have them. I can show them to you. It's not a heart attack. There's something not normal, and it's very obvious by the photos that there's something not normal. You don't deglove your foot, which means all the skin removes and it turns inside out from a heart attack. And you don't have patches of skin missing from a heart attack.
I do wonder, though, if the degloving of his foot, because
he was binding it.
Doing something to his foot.
I think he twisted his ankle.
Mm-hmm.
And he called and said, I casted it and got it stuck in something. He hurt his ankle that night. It's so obvious that he hurt it that night. He tries to cast it. He calls his brother. I've hurt my foot. Ray says, go to the doctor tomorrow, do something. But he's so stubborn and he's so smart. He's going to make his own cast and make his own brace. And he got his foot stuck in some kind of plaster. And that could explain that one, because he was binding it so it wouldn't hurt. And he was cutting off the circulation so it wouldn't hurt. That could definitely explain the degloving. But it doesn't explain all the other marks on his body.
The medical examiner concluded that Ralph did die of a heart attack and that alcoholic liver disease was a contributing factor. There was no ready explanation for the skin lost on his right foot and ankle. In their notes of the incident, sheriff's deputies wondered if Ralph's wounds could have been caused by a chemical burn or steam. As you heard from Suzanne, Ralph had been binding his foot and ankle because of the pain he was having. What was causing the pain? We know that he complained to his brother about hurting his ankle back on September 5, 1976, but we're not sure if it was the same ankle that had the severe wound when he died. Doty also wrote in her manuscript that in 1977, Ralph tried to make a cast for his foot and ankle. He soon realized the cast was too tight, so he tried to soak it to soften it. The cast swelled, increasing the pressure and tightness on his foot. He then called Ray for help, but Ray wasn't available that day. We're not sure how that issue was eventually resolved, or again, if the injury he was treating was related to the ankle he injured the previous year. Clearwater officials said Ray told them that Ralph would often bind his foot tight enough to stop the circulation because of the severe pain he was having. We're not doctors, but it does sound like Ralph's heart disease, severe foot pain, and self-treatment could all be connected. Our amateur research into heart conditions did provide a plausible explanation. Most of the injuries on his body appeared to be arterial ulcers, which are incredibly painful sores with a punched-out appearance. They're caused by heart disease and poor circulation, and they're prone to appear on the lower extremities. If untreated, they can lead to death of the affected body tissue, also known as gangrene. If you're interested in seeing what we found, Google arterial ulcer. If any doctors are listening, feel free to correct us or offer a counterpoint. We would definitely be interested in hearing an expert's opinion. We also want to remind you that Ralph's father died of a heart attack when he was only 39, so it doesn't seem out of the realm of possibility that Ralph could meet the same fate at a young age. Now, I don't want to give the impression that we're taking Ralph's death lightly. No matter what our opinions are about his guilt or innocence, he still had rights, and family members earnestly believed that Ralph had been the victim of police brutality. Worst of all, Natalie and Suzanne had lost another parent. It was devastating for them. Suzanne's older sister, Natalie, spent years trying to discover what happened to both her parents. She gathered binders full of police and newspaper reports related to her mother's disappearance and her father's death.
So we could look and see, what happened? Why does one family think one thing and another family think another thing? And you read through it, and the more that I read through it, the more that I, probably 10 pages in, was telling my sister, my father's guilty. There's nobody else but him who knows what happened to our mother. And I know what I saw was real. This is real. My sister didn't want to believe that. She wanted to believe that our dad was this loving, wonderful person who would never hurt her or us. So she tried to prove by going through this, that they missed things, that they overlooked things, that there was leads that they could have looked into, that, you know, that our mom left. And she was in the process of years. She had actually reached out to Idaho State Patrol and was trying to sue the state of Idaho, saying this is so wrongly done and there's so much injustice in this case. She spent years, years, years on the case. Natalie wanted to prove that the police had tortured him to get answers about where my mother was located at. And obviously the police deny any involvement, and they say that he was drunk when they picked him up and he fell. He was drunk and he fell and he hurt himself, but his blood alcohol is 0.01 on the autopsy, I believe. That is not intoxicated.
By now, you've probably wondered why you haven't heard from Natalie, Suzanne's older sister. In 2006, another tragedy struck. Natalie, her husband, son, and a friend of her son's were all overcome by carbon monoxide during a Memorial Day weekend boat outing. When the boat was found, it appeared the group had taken shelter from the cool weather under a storage tarp snapped onto the boat's exterior. The boat's engine and a propane heater produced carbon monoxide fumes, which couldn't dissipate under the boat cover. Suzanne had lost another lifeline.
And there was a time when at our house, we got our own bedrooms for the first time in all those years. And I think we were 17 or 18. And I used to sneak back into her room. I literally could not sleep without her. And I'm like, I'm the most pathetic 17-year-old ever. I have to have my sister. But we would just sit and talk, just like we had always done. And she would comfort me and encourage me. She was a mother and a father and a best friend all in one.
The clearest course forward to Suzanne was to pick up the torch Natalie had been carrying and try to find justice for her mom and hopefully finally bring her home. Which brings us to the summer of 2021, when she scrolled through Facebook and saw a drawing of a woman who looked eerily familiar.
So I reach out to Redgrave Research, who did the 3D forensic drawing, and I send them a picture of my mother and me side by side. And I said, how did you draw this photo? It looks like you drew my mother and I had a baby together, because it's her and I together. And I thought, I'm going to wait for months to hear back from this guy because he's back east somewhere. I'm going to wait for months. Within hours, Anthony got back to me. And I thought that was a good sign that Anthony got back to me so quickly. And I reach out to the cold case team who's on this Facebook page, who actually is the one that created the page to get this going. And I realized since 2018, they have been trying to give this Jane Doe a name.
The Findlay Creek team is headed by volunteer investigators Jason Futch and Melinda Jetterberg. You heard Melinda's voice at the Jane Doe site in the last episode.
So I'm messaging Mel. Hey Mel, you found a body. I'm missing a body. Let's talk. Right? This is my mom. She's 5'3", 130 pounds. Caucasian female with blonde hair, last seen wearing red pants and a white shirt. And you have a body matching that. And they told us in 1978 it wasn't my mom. I literally have a paper right here that says it's not her. What dental records did they use? How did they compare her? How do I know it's not her?
As we said in the last episode, in 1990, the Findlay Creek Jane Doe case was labeled as unsolvable and was closed. The Jane Doe's remains were cremated, and all the associated evidence was destroyed. The remains were then lost, wiping out hopes of finding a DNA match. Melinda, who many call Mel, spent months in the early part of the pandemic chasing down leads to try to find out what happened to those remains. She ran into dead end after dead end. The funeral home where the Jane Doe had been sent had changed ownership, and the previous owner had passed away. The new owner couldn't find any records of the remains. Then, Mel had a conversation with an Idaho detective about an unrelated case. When she mentioned her frustration with this case, the detective suggested she check with the coroner's office in Walla Walla, Washington, which, in 1990, was the closest community with a crematorium.
I never thought to do that, because I just assumed she was at the funeral home. And then there was another conversation. He said, yeah, get a hold of the docent at the Walla Walla coroner's office, because they keep really good records. I was like, oh, okay, I guess I can do that. And then I had also talked to the city of Walla Walla, a representative of the city of Walla Walla, and he had said the same thing. They're like, get a hold of the coroner's office. So I get a hold of Richard Greenwood. I emailed him. And I had to email him a couple times, because again, you know, we had this whole pandemic thing going on. And then he said, so I found this bag of remains. They look kind of old, and they have half a sticker on them from the funeral home that she was sent to. And I just went,
The remains the coroner found were labeled as a John Doe, not a Jane Doe. And the location noted on the file of where the unidentified remains were first found didn't match. But the case number written on the side of a piece of paper did match the Findlay Creek Jane Doe. So did the name of the investigator assigned to the case. Feeling hopeful, Mel contacted the Oregon State forensic anthropologist, who then coordinated with Washington State to see what could be done with the remains. The first task for forensic DNA analysts is to see if any genetic material can be extracted from the remains. Despite advancements in testing, it's difficult to extract DNA from cremated bones because extreme heat destroys the organic material. The remains were sent to a Canadian lab in late August of 2021 in an attempt to get answers. Kathy Taylor, a forensic anthropologist in Washington State, was invaluable in facilitating the transfer of the remains. The team was crushed to learn in August that she passed away before the results were available. We were at Suzanne's house when the news was delivered about her death.
So Richard Greenwood and the coroner and I have been communicating with Dr. Taylor, who is an outstanding anthropologist, similar to Dr. Vance in the state of Oregon. And I knew she hadn't been feeling well, so I'm absolutely shocked too. She's a young lady. She's totally dedicated to the state of Washington and to finding unidentified, and like, she is the bone expert. She carries her phone with her when she's on vacation, and they will text her all the time with random bones, and she's incredible.
It says Dr. Kathy Taylor says she passed away on August 1st, and it says her work also served as a critical link in solving criminal investigations, including the Green River Killer murders.
Mm-hmm. She's phenomenal. She identified the youngest Green River Killer victim. And she was super responsive.
Another blow came in December when the lab said there was no usable DNA in the remains. But the team is undeterred. They know that Suzanne's best shot of getting DNA for comparison with the Jane Doe to herself is in finding undiscovered bone left behind on the hillside where investigators combed for remains in 1978.
So, but yeah, this is the area right in here.
Wow.
So, yeah, and I mean, you know, you look at that tree right there, it's probably only 30 years old, if even that. So, yeah, there's a lot of growth in here because this was a lot more open. There was a lot more, well, you can imagine.
Yeah.
Because it hasn't been touched in 40 years. I haven't been in here and logged, it doesn't look like.
No.
So.
Was there a lot more ground cover at the time, or was it?
There was a lot more scrub. A lot more scrub brush and more of these grasses and ferns. I think I remember ferns.
Rob Parr's memory was accurate. It matched the crime scene photos Mel received when she got copies of the Jane Doe case file.
It's like he was looking at pictures that I had already seen. So it was
But
insane.
He's not describing pictures that he's seen. He's describing his memory of the moment.
Because I had always assumed that they were taking the pictures as they were excavating. And Rob's like, no, I saw the skull. I saw the ribs. It was all out.
And he talked about the jaw being over-separate.
And the shoes. He's like, I saw all of that. And I was like, that's exactly what the pictures look like that I have. So I don't...
You've never seen the pictures.
Yeah. Because I've never published them anywhere. Those don't go anywhere.
Retired DA Dale Mammon remembered a similar scene.
And we parked in a parking spot beside a rural, very rural road. And it was pointed out down a small embankment up on the other side. And then beside a log was this body in a very, very shallow grave, or the remains of the body, I should say, in a shallow grave. And that's what we found at that point. And then it was sort of a quasi-open area, not overgrown. And we had no difficulty in looking down the creek in a northerly direction or a southerly direction, maybe 15 or 20 feet, and there was a downed tree that had been there a long time, and it was right beside the tree in a quasi open area, 5 or 10, 15 feet wide, that is where the body was found.
Pre-DNA testing, investigators had little to go on to try to identify the woman.
One, there were no reported missing persons in Northeast Oregon, and that's the 4 or 5 county area here. And certainly it would have, in the law enforcement community, been common knowledge had there been somebody missing. It was, as I recall, about the time that the homicides were occurring in the Green River area of, around Seattle. And our conversation speculation was, well, there's another one that they that happened to in from that area, and got this far and decided to dispose of the body or whatever they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
But there were never any. I think the law enforcement did make inquiry, and no missing persons were reported even in that area at that time.
Soon, we're going to talk about who the woman could be if it's not Patty Otto. But for now, let's focus on what's been happening at the gravesite.
So, this is what we have narrowed down. When we were up there, we had come out for about 15 minutes because she had odor and was not able to figure out where it was coming from. And so, we went ahead and took her out so she would quit being frustrated. And then put her back in, and we put her back in a different area, so hoping it'd be like a fresh take. So it worked in that a lot of the odor that she'd been confused with before was no longer, she wasn't catching it. So that is a rule out. There was no longer, you know, something here. It was like, I don't have anything. So we worked back down. So this is good and bad. We worked back down. She still has serious interest below where it's believed the body was found. It is super thick. So she goes back to it, so she's not alerting. She's not like, it's right here. She works in, there's like that big, big down tree, and we've marked it. So I have the waypoints and stuff. We've marked it, and we moved it so she could get into it, and she snuffs and snuffs. And then she's like, I don't know. And so she'll work her way down the tree a little bit, and she comes back. And she'll go to the other side of the tree and work back. So, and then we take her out past to see if the odor could be coming in from somewhere else. And so that's where we're at, is that she definitely has odor. And thankfully, the second time in, we were able to rule out because, you know, saw how far out she kept working. I was like, oh my goodness. That's a lot of area. Right, and there could be... It would be unusual though to have it that far up and that far down. And what I saw, because when we went back in, it had clouded over, so the sun was no longer shining in there. And I think that's what happened. I think it quit pulling the odor up, because sun directly on an odor pulls it very quickly. So it's hard. A lot of times that's why we talk about daytime and stuff, because if we have a lot of sun in an area, our odor can just go straight up and the dog doesn't get it very well at all. So it's good and bad. I mean, the area allows odor to be held, so that's good. But it's so thick that it means we have to keep honing in.
Amity Larson and her dog Bryn went back to the site 3 months later in November 2021 with another handler, Gail Collins, and her search dog Wyatt.
And that day, it was a little bit sunny. We had a nice breeze. It was about 50 degrees, a little more moisture. So it was much better search conditions than when I had been there in August. Her dog showed indications of having odor in the same regions that Bryn had in August. And interestingly, her dog went to where the burial site, where we believe the burial site was, and actually had put his foot on, he put his nose on it, he put his paw on it, and he would kind of do like a scuff with his paw. And he was very interested in that area, kept going back to it frequently, and showed a lot of interest there. The thing about that dog, I've trained with him extensively, and he's a dog that whenever he's dealt with buried source, likes to touch the spot. So he's not a digger in general, but he always has, when we've had buried material and that he's been searching for, he frequently will show that same behavior where he puts his foot down and he scuffs the ground, almost like he's trying to help himself smell better. And the other thing about him, he's a dog that likes to be 100% accurate. So we didn't get a trained final response from him on that location either.
A trained final response is when a dog gives a signal that it absolutely has found what it's trained to find, whether that's an injured hiker or human remains. These dogs don't alert to other animal remains. They know what they're looking for. After sniffing the area we believe was the gravesite, the dog moved further along the trail and up the hill a bit and got extremely interested in a cluster of trees.
But we had to actually remove him, physically remove him from the area, because he wouldn't stop working to locate the source of the smell, the odor, as he was working. But he was actually standing up on the trees, against them, sniffing up into the air, and then he would work down to the bottom of the trees. We would pull him out of that immediate area and let him go, and he would come right back in and start working it again. So we were very interested in that area because of his behavior.
But they couldn't be certain that Wyatt had found the source of an odor, because heat and wind can play tricks on a dog's nose, trapping odor in an area that's several feet or even yards away from the source.
A dog could get into an area and have odor, but not actually have remains right there. there's somewhere in the vicinity, or there's, you know, there's a reason in the vicinity that it's causing the odor to be there. But it doesn't mean the dog's wrong. It just means that that's where it's most concentrated. The odor is most concentrated.
Amity and Gail used an app to get the GPS coordinates of the spot where Wyatt was signaling, but the GPS malfunctioned. Fortunately, they also took pictures of the area because they wanted to bring in Bryn to see how she would react.
This time, she had more interest closer to the gravesite than what she did before. Before, she worked much farther out from it and had odor, but this time she was much closer to the gravesite in her interest. She still did not give a trained final response in the gravesite area, in that immediate area. This is when we were working, that's when we discovered that we had the wrong GPS, because we had GPSed the spot where Wyatt had been so interested in the trees. And it was something wrong with the GPS. So we didn't actually know where it was. So we just went ahead and worked the area. And the really interesting part for us as handlers was that we were keeping an eye out, trying to kind of work our way back. We really had no idea where we had been because we were just following the dogs, letting them work. And as we were getting back into an area, I stopped and I had my phone up from the picture I'd taken. And Bryn went in and started working in some trees. And I pulled up the photograph, and Gail was looking at the photograph with me. And I said, I think this is it. And Gail said, yes, I think that's right. And we looked up, and my dog was giving a trained final response.
Next time on Still.
Somebody had spotted the car with a Tapadera motor in. And so I called the Tapadera just to be, like, try to be discreet, just because that's a long drive, right? And we're like, is she still registered? Yes. And the manager said, yeah, she just paid for another night.
Anyone with information pertaining to the disappearance of Patricia Otto should contact the Lewiston Police Department's tip line at 208-298-3939. Anyone with information pertaining to the identity of the Findlay Creek Jane Doe or other information related to that case should contact the Union County District Attorney at da@union-county.org. If you or anyone you know is a victim of domestic abuse, please contact the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-SAFE. Still is a production of The Reporter's Notebook and Grayson Shaw Media. You can connect with us online at thereportersnotebook.com or via email at info@thereportersnotebook.com. Still was researched, written, and produced by Karen Shaw Anderson. Additional research and script editing provided by Christine Hughes. Original music by Smith Uoso. I'm your host and associate producer, Gary Anderson. Special thanks to everyone who graciously provided interviews and helped with our research. We would specifically like to thank the Advocates for Patricia Otto and the Findlay Creek Jane Doe Task Force. Like, follow, and subscribe to Still on your favorite podcast platform. And follow us on Facebook or Twitter to join the conversation. Ezekiel 34:16. I will seek the lost, and I will bring back the strayed, and I will bind up the injured, and I will strengthen the weak.